Hello. This is a recording of an event held at the State Library of New South Wales. This recording was made on Gadigal land where the State Library of New South Wales stands. Lands that have been cared for and nurtured by the Gadigal people for millennia and have an incredible history of storytelling and creativity. We pay our respects to elders past and present. We hope you enjoy this recording.
We are here this afternoon to celebrate the 2023 National Biography Award. Since 1996, this award has celebrated excellence in biography, autobiography, and memoir writing. And with a prize pool of $42,000, it's the nation's richest prize in this genre. Over the years, the award has been won by a series of esteemed writers such as Don Watson, Judith Brett, Cassandra Pybus, and Brenda Nile. And the subjects have been wide-ranging, from prime ministers, Paul Keating, Alfred Deakin, William McMahon, media heavyweight Keith Murdoch, poets Roberta Sykes and CJ Dennis, soprano Dame Nellie Melba, architects Walter Burley Griffin and his wife Marion Griffin, and also recently Aboriginal Tasmanian woman Truganini. The recognition of these writers' works wouldn't be possible without philanthropic support. The National Biography Award has been a fixture on Australia's literary calendar thanks to the generosity of Dr. Geoffrey Keynes, the late Michael Crouch AC, and the Nelson Mears Foundation. This year, the award is generously supported by the State Library of New South Wales Foundation, Sam Mears AO, Rob Thomas AO, and the Holman family. Thank you very much for your support of this important award. This year we received 94 entries and they were judged by Suzanne Faulkner, Mandy Sayer and Rick Morton, who are joining us today. Thank you all for your service to this award, not only this year but over the last 3 years. It's really appreciated. And the shortlisted books this year were Unknown, A Refugee's Story by Akuk Kwol Anya, Ghost Tattoo, Discovering the Hidden Truth of My Father's Holocaust by Tony Bernard, How to End a Story, Diaries 1995 to 1998 by Helen Garner, and Bedtime Story by Chloe Hooper, published by Scribner. And the winner this year of the 2023 Michael Crouch Award for a debut work is Tom Patterson for his book Missing, and the winner of the 2023 National Biography Award, Anne-Marie Priest, for her biography of Gwen Harwood, titled My Tongue Is My Own. Please join me in a round of applause. Congratulations. So we're very lucky today to be hearing from both of our winners. Firstly, I'd like to invite to the stage Rick and Tom. So Rick Morton is a journalist, author himself, and as I mentioned earlier, a judge of this award. And Tom's first book is this one we're talking about today, Missing. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Tom Patterson, welcome.
Thanks very much, Rick.
I don't know how much you're learning through this process, but the literary community can be a little bit precious sometimes. And you're a water engineer. What are you doing on this stage?
What are you saying about engineers, Rick?
I just think you're very clever. You know what you're looking at when you see structural pieces. But you're not by birth a writer. I'm so fascinated.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because traditionally lawyers move into writing. That's what they do. And if anyone has read the drivel that lawyers write in their submissions, it is absolutely appalling. It is obfuscating. It's boring. Now, look, the engineering thing, I structured my approach to writing the book like an engineering project in many ways. So I had a very set filing system. I had a spreadsheet, you'll be pleased to know.
I love this.
Yeah, so I didn't really know much about this bloke, and every time I found a place and time that I could put him in, then I would put it in a spreadsheet, and so I could order it afterwards and know where he was and what he was doing. I also had technical reviewers, like I would in an engineering project. so it was very similar.
Schematics,
yeah. I had a GIS file with all the places he was down there, I did.
Okay, so I feel like just by way of introduction, I mean, as a judge of a literary prize, you wait sometimes years to find a book like Missing that you know immediately is a special story and has a special subject and just captures you in ways that you find hard to articulate sometimes. And this is a story about a man called Mark May, a man who in many respects I think struggled with the world and his place in it, and who disappeared essentially for 35 years into the northwest New South Wales bushland, or the gorges, around near where you grew up.
That's right, yeah.
How did you come across Mark May?
So I have known the May family for 30-odd years, I suppose, and I've got Pete May in the audience tonight here, who it's really Pete who gave me so much of the information I needed to write the book. And I had seen them just after they'd gone down to find Mark in the gorges, and that's how I first heard about the story.
They were looking for Mark because they hadn't heard from him for a few months by this point. He would occasionally keep in touch over these 35 years and drop in, and they knew roughly that he was okay, but in this instance they were worried.
Yeah, Mark was very paranoid, so the only form of identification he had on him was his ANU union membership, and he'd been kicked out of the union in 1973, and that was his only form of ID. He wouldn't have a post office, he wouldn't have a mobile phone, he wouldn't have anything. Occasionally he'd leave notes in a certain log near one of his camps and they would communicate like that, but it was pretty haphazard.
Would you mind just reading? There's a diary entry from Mark, which I really think sums up a lot of his thinking at this point in time in his life. He's a young man, it's 11th of March 1973, where he's just wondering about his place in the world. Just from the start of that arrow,
I often wonder if our society is worth it all. They're spending about 20 years of my life preparing me to live in it, live by it and live for it. They use a lot of people up just to perpetuate. Even in the dark ages, the average peasant would have felt security and significance. He was part of a long tradition and the raison d'etre of his life and the object of much inquiry and elucidation. He lived to die. Death was a lot closer to life. He had a little less pleasure and a bit more happiness. He was part of a body, the Catholic Church, which had all the answers, tied all aspects of life together and provided him with a perfect philosophy. We don't have that.
I don't want to over-egg it, but I relate so much to that sometimes. And having been raised Catholic, I do miss the order and sometimes the pomp and ceremony of a Catholic Mass, I must admit. Mark was one of seven boys?
That's right, yeah.
One of seven boys.
Second of seven.
To Phil and Esma. Who are just a remarkable couple in their own right, I think. Can you tell me a little bit about Mark's upbringing, the brothers, the family, and you know the fact that the Catholic Church did run through that family?
So we should start with Phil. Phil was this incredible character. He had grown up on the banks of the Hawkesbury River in Sydney. His parents were subsistence farmers, and somehow this kid had got himself a scholarship to St Joseph's College here in Sydney, so Catholic boarding school. He matriculated at the age of 16, almost topped the state, but because his parents were poor, he didn't have any money, so he went for 2 years felling timber near Dorigo to get some cash together, but then won a scholarship to Sydney University, and then got a job up near Armidale at the CSIRO up there as a statistician. His particular thing was the cycling of sulphur in sheep pasture.
I mean, of course. I was about to say the same thing.
Yeah, and Esma, her family from Adelaide, I think, originally. They were big in hotels. They would trade hotels. And she was a remarkable woman herself. And she, again, very strong Catholic.
Her family weren't necessarily so keen on Phil at the beginning, is that right?
No, Phil, her family were a bit more wealthy, and Phil was he was a bit poorer, yeah, and they didn't...
They give her a car or some form of present to want to escape?
In Mark's notes, he describes this thing where... So they were living in Armidale in the early days. They were living in a fairly rough house, which Phil had done his best to make good. Her father gave her a house in Sydney, and it was a way out. You know, he was getting this really barbed gift. But they used the capital from that to buy a farm near... Well, to buy a block of land near Armidale. And then Phil, pretty much on his own, built a house on it for his family to live in. And the way he did that is he'd get up at 4 in the morning and he'd take the older boys down there and he'd just work and work until he got it done.
there's a really beautiful passage where you explain Phil's advice to the boys about having the need to work not just today but tomorrow. So you've got to have this kind of balance in the way you leverage your body. And it felt almost like a philosophy.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see it in his sons. Is they're all very proud of their physical prowess. You know, that's something that means a lot to them. These men who are, you know, brilliant in their own right. They're doctors and they've got PhDs and that sort of thing. But their physical characteristics, something that mean a lot to them.
When did you first come across this story, and why did you think it needed to be told?
That's a bit grand, the need to be told thing. But I'd been scratching around for a story. The story about the brothers going down into the bush to find one of their own, it just seemed to me like such an incredible image. You know, just really beautiful. And then information kept dripping through to me. So I thought, look, just on that image alone, you could write a couple of thousand words and it could go in the Good Weekend sort of thing. And then I got the police report, and the police report had all the questions that I wanted to ask about the day, all the really hard questions about what had happened. It had all of his criminal history in it. And, you know, from there, bits of information came through. But it was really, Pete came to Sydney one day and said, "Oh, man, I've got something for you." And he gave me this removalist box, sort of that size, shabby old removalist box. And he said, "Oh, look, have a look in here. You might find some stuff that are useful to you." And it was full of Mark's writing, about 400,000 words of an unpublished memoir in two parts, and poetry and plans he had for paintings and various odd things. And I had then this guy's perspective on his life until he was about 32. And I thought, oh, there's a book in there. Actually, no, I need to put some responsibility to someone else here. I brought that box back to David Marr's house, and he looked at it and he said, 100,000 words. And I did it in 50.
He's got a good eye, David Marr. He should sometimes do something with his life.
Yeah, that's right.
Mark is such a complicated character, because I found myself kind of on his side for so long throughout this book, and he's not just intellectually torn about his place in the world, but he actually lives that inability to stick at something. So he tries university. In fact, someone gives him advice saying, I've studied law and then join the church because the church will need lawyers. That person should read Fortunes. But he was abused by people in his life. He goes to university. He doesn't, you know, he's partly obsessed with learning and knowledge, and, you know, he's just read Aristotle, so he's going to quote it in a letter, which reminds me of myself. But then he's like, no, none of this matters, and he wants to go and do hard work and test his hands and be hard again. And he never quite finds, you know, a way to make all of those things work except to disappear and to write and walk the bush.
Yeah, that's right. In his childhood, when he was in moments of... after he was assaulted twice as a kid, both times he goes into the bush as a way of getting away from it. And as an older man, he, like, you've talked about all the grandeur of his ideas and what he was trying to do, but there was also, you know, he was in his early 30s, nothing had worked. You know, he tried lots of things and nothing had worked. And the bush kind of worked, and he was able to keep on making it work. It took incredible effort to do it, but that seemed to be a place that he could be and live. And what started off as a bit of a retreat, I think, despite all this grand language and ideas, he came to love it. He just loved his life out there.
He did go through this horrendous period. Well, maybe it never ended, really, but a particularly bad period at university and beyond, where he tried almost every drug known to mankind, tore through them voluminously, I guess, and did things that no doubt that he felt ashamed of in some moments, but perhaps wasn't aware of in others. Who was that person? What was Mark trying to do in those moments when he was just doing everything?
So, in his notes, so, and we've got to separate what he says in his notes and what he's justifying in his notes. You know, what's actually happened and what's self-justification. So, in his notes, Mark was one of those hippies who believed that he was going to create this brand new world, that the old world was over and finished, and he was going to create this incredible new thing with the people he was with in part at ANU. And part of that was access to the subconscious. He believed that through this knowledge, he would be able to find this new world and find a better way to live, and that would start this new utopia. And part of that was taking drugs. You know, he loved acid. He loved all sorts of things. And he says it was a way of raising consciousness. And the second part of his memoir is written, you know, there's 10,000 words of a Plato's dialogue style thing written around a circle at ANU. It's almost impossible to read. It is so tiresome. But that's how he thought, and that's what he was trying to do. Whether that's the truth and whether he's just escaping, I'm not 100% sure, or whether it's a blend of the two.
I mean, I think the thing about a book like this is that we will never know. His family doesn't know, really. But we do get glimpses of the man. And I kind of half finished a thought before, which is something I do a lot. You know, I was rooting for him. And then he has a kid and breaks my heart because he acts in a way that, even though I don't know Mark May, he acts like someone I was like, that's not you, Mark. He's kind of doesn't want to know anything about this pregnant woman who he's just knocked up. And then again, doesn't really want to be in the kid's life. Can you tell me a little bit about that thread of the story?
It's really hard for me because I spent 4 years on this. If you're with someone for that amount of time, you, like you said, you've got to be kind of rooting for them. And when he does that, you think, oh, mate, this is so tough. It's also hard because in the first half of his memoir, he's quite hard on his dad. I know I don't think that his analysis of his dad's right. He's got him wrong quite a bit. But then he turns around and does this terrible thing. He just ignores his son and ignores the woman that he's having his son with. So, that was tough. I interviewed Keir and Jen a couple of times for the book. They're such wonderful people as well. It's hard to imagine not wanting to be a part of their lives.
I mean, you get the sense that, you know, sometimes people tell you that, you know, the answer if you're questioning life is children, is to raise the next generation, but that wasn't enough either. And so I then wonder really what was the problem at the centre of Mark's life that he was trying to escape from?
Yes, look, I don't know. And it's part of the reason of presenting material in this way is that you get to choose your own adventure on this. I went to visit one of his mates who he was with at uni, who was heavily into drugs as well. And this guy got out, I really liked him. He was a really good guy. But he'd obviously given his body a really hard time. He looked pretty rough. He just got over Hep C, and he said, look, Mark would have had Hep C as well. Sorry, where was the question going again?
Well, just like, I mean, is there something that he was trying... I mean, is there an essential fundamental problem at the centre of Mark?
Oh, okay. So I described... And this guy in later life became a psychologist. I described Mark's sexual assaults to him, particularly the second one, which is the important one. And this guy just crumpled and he said, oh, no, I could have fixed him. So I think that's right at the heart of it. The trauma of that... he explained it to me, and I'm not going to be able to do it justice to explain it to you, but it doesn't properly go away unless it's treated properly, and it wasn't treated properly.
It's really tough knowing all of these things. He's also a very funny guy, as is often the case with people who have suffered anything in their lives. And perhaps he didn't intend this to be funny, but there's a period where he first goes into the gorge, and he's there for a few years doing his disappearing act, and then he decides to join the public service. In Canberra, which is a well-worn path, I think.
As a clerk, like the lowest, you know, job he could find.
It's kind of cute. I mean, it's kind of a break in his story, and then he goes back to the gorge having decided, you know what, I tried that, not for me. And I respect that. He gave it a go. Did that kind of disabuse him of his notions that were early on in his life, that maybe the people he went to uni with, they were going to change the world, and now they're climbing up the hierarchy in Canberra?
Yes, it seemed to. It's hard to piece together this part of his life. So I found his public service card in amongst his possessions. It's like, what? You know? And so I contacted the public service, and they were able to give me some details, and I'd had some of his writings about it. I suspect what happened as well is he went back there and got back into the drug scene. And so that was hard too. So, you know, although he... You know, the revolution hadn't happened and he wasn't able to do it. It was also, he was back into the drugs.
Mind you, he never really left them because he made a pretty good living in the strictest subsistence sense of the word, selling pot that he grew in the gorges and then hiked out of there in huge swaths, in very, you know, carefully parcelled, carefully packaged.
I've got to be careful here. Huge swaths? No. The country he was living in is beautiful and hard. It's hard country. And there are basically no flat areas and the soil is poor. To grow his crops, so we found a couple of enclosures that he'd built out of saplings and some wire. I don't know how he got the wire in there, but wire is heavy. And... I think we found two enclosures, and I suspect there weren't many more. They were 3 by 2 metres. You know, we're not talking about a big crop. And when I spoke to the policeman, who's a minor hero in this story, I think, actually, Tom Grace, I said, oh, mate, so were you thinking about Mark's crop? And he said, no, never. You know, it was pretty small scale. And... You know, we're talking about a backpack's worth that he'd sort of hike out. And something I didn't put in the book, but Mark got a lift. I'd heard from someone that Mark had got a lift into town once and paid for the lift with some of his dope, and it wasn't any good.
I don't have too much more time left. Are we doing questions at the end or... no, okay, well, good. At the afternoon tea. But I did, throughout all his years in there, I mean, I think I ascribe so much to the marijuana crop because it took up so much of his attention because he was protecting it from cattle who would occasionally come through and eat it trample it and threaten it. And the rains, the floods, the droughts, it was just like this man versus crop.
Absolutely. And so he wrote a poem of about 20,000 words and it's written in... it's written like the man from Snowy River, da 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 da. You know that rhythm, and his talk about it. That it's the language of kings in grass castles. It's Mary Durack or your family. You know,
they were bastards in grass castles. Yeah.
But like, it's this. You know, he was, and one of the farmers there. He said, "Look, he's part of the pastoral history out here," and he. He sort of saw himself as some sort of settler, some sort of pastoralist, some sort of... And the work he put into it, like the... When you see the how he had to get water from the river up to these places that he was growing his crops, it's just huge amounts of work, absolutely enormous. And the equipment that he had in there, these 200-litre drums and various other things, just extraordinary. How do you... You know, they would have to be carried in individually down this incredibly steep path, which he'd made himself. Just amazing, amazing amount of work.
That was the most difficult route, and then paved it basically with rocks.
Absolutely, yeah. So he to disguise where he was, he basically started his path down a really obvious spur, which takes you a really dangerous path down into the gorges as. Pete and Steve and Liz and Dave found when they followed the path and almost killed themselves, you know, getting down there was really scary. And he just made this staircase that goes off the side of the mountain and down, which I've walked a couple of times now, and it's astonishing. And it's quick too. It's not just that. And to have built it, like every step has to be built by him over years and years. Yeah.
It really is phenomenal. And, I mean, there's so much we haven't spoken about. I don't think we're giving anything away. In fact, we're not. When I say that Mark died in the gorge where he had spent most of his life.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's in the first couple of pages, so yeah. That's
Well, I mean, like you say that, but also I wasn't entirely sure when I was reading, so I was like, oh, maybe. but I'm also naive. I shouldn't be a journalist for that reason. It's a beautiful book, and it's stunning in the way that you write it. You've got a real flair for the Australian countryside, and an engineered structure that works. Of course it works. It's so good. Tom, it's a work of art. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ruth.
Thank you so much. My husband's an engineer, so I'm promptly going to go home and tell him that he should be writing a book as well. It now gives me great pleasure to introduce our next speakers. So Dr. Bernadette Brennan won last year's National Biography Award for her biography of Julian Mears titled Leaping into Waterfalls. Bernadette also recently wrote an award-winning biography of Helen Garner, who was one of our shortlisted authors this year. So who better to interview Anne-Marie Priest, who's written about another one of Australia's incredible women writers, Gwen Harwood. So, thank you.
Thank you, and congratulations, Anne-Marie. Who better? Well, I don't know about that, but it's a real privilege to be here today and talk to Anne-Marie about this book. Gwen Harwood was one of my favourite poets when I studied at Sydney University, and it turned out I was taught her poetry by a number of the characters, well, certainly one of the main characters in this book, Vivian Smith. There's a quote on the front of this book that says, Harwood deserves a sympathetic and lively biography. Anne-Marie Priest, to her credit, has written that book. This is such a good book. This is such a good book. Congratulations. Look, that's only about a fifth of my stickies, and they're ones I've kept in for further research of other things. So off we go, and we've only got half an hour. I'm just wondering if we might start by, if I ask you in the audience, who is familiar with Gwen Harwood and her poetry? Okay, so not a whole lot of people. So can I start, Anne-Marie, by asking you why Harwood, and how did you come up with this idea, and how did you discover her for this project?
Okay, thank you so much for your kind words. Yeah, I didn't actually discover Harwood as a poet initially. I discovered her as a person, or I say, I was actually in a bookshop, in a secondhand bookshop in Melbourne, and I was just browsing in the Australian writing section, which is a thing that I do, and I found this collection of her letters written when she was in her 20s from Brisbane, called Blessed City, and I just kind of opened it and started reading, and I just couldn't believe this voice that came leaping out of these pages at me. She was so irreverent, and you know how you kind of think people from the 40s were like just very straight-laced, not like us, and she's just having a go at the public service, and she was hilarious, but she was also, there was also this really strong sense of vocation there that she wanted to do something with her life, a sense of meaning. I just wanted to know who she was. I needed to find out about her. And so I bought that book and I read that, and then I bought other books of her letters that were published, and I read all of those, and I started reading her poetry, and I loved it. And then I had to know all the secrets, which were to me really obvious.
There's a lot of secrets.
So many secrets, because she passed away in 1995, and she was always very, very good. She was quite famous by the time she died, but she was very good at keeping people at arm's length, journalists in particular. And so if she would write a poem about a lost love, and it would often be quite explicit or quite, you know, sexual, and she would be asked about it, she would just stonewall, like, I don't know what you're talking about. This is, you know, and this is a metaphor. It's all about the relationship between the individual and art or something like that. So, yeah, but it was obvious to me that there were things going on. And so I tracked down Greg Kratzman, who I believe then was writing Gwen's biography. And he had been a friend of Gwen's and was writing it in the 90s before she died. And as far as I knew, that biography was still coming out, but I wanted to know what he knew. And he said to me, oh, I'm not doing the biography anymore. That's done. I'm not doing that. I've done the letters. I've done a collected poems, and that's the end of it for me. So at that point, I had a little, maybe I could write the biography. But when I finally, sort of a couple of years later, got the courage to say that to Greg, he was like, oh, don't. It was just, and yeah, don't.
We should probably duck in here to suggest to people who don't know Gwen. Gwen Harwood was this very, born in 1920, dies 1995, very sweet, lovely housewife from Tasmania with four children. And that's the impression that she gave to a lot of the world. And so this idea of this woman who was feisty and electrifying and sensual beyond measure, with this wickedness, didn't quite seem to fit. So obviously there's a lot going on. Why hasn't this come out? Now, there's a bit more of the story to the biography beginning, is there not, with Alison Hoddenott?
Oh,
to tell. Could you share that with the audience?
Yes, yeah. Well, in the early 90s, Gwen was quite keen to have somebody write her biography, but I think she imagined that she would be stage managing. And so she had her very good friend, long-term friend and scholar, she told her that she could be the official biographer. And then Greg came along and said, look, I'd really like to write the biography. She said, of course, you write the biography. And then each one of them would start to be a bit like, oh, I've heard that you've given access to the letters to, you know, to Greg. Well, oh, no, you are my official biographer. And then the other way around, oh, I'm a bit worried I'm not going to get access. Oh, no, you can have access to everything. And so, and it just started to get ridiculous for the two of them. And unfortunately, they sort of pitted against each other. And eventually Alison withdrew and Greg continued, but yeah, Gwen died while he was still in the process of producing it, and at that point the literary executors, which was Gwen's eldest son, John Harwood, who's written about this subsequently, said that certain things, all the things that Gwen had told Greg about her life, could not be published or could not be included in the biography. And I mean, Greg probably could have called his bluff and done that, but he had good relationships with the family and Gwen's husband was still alive and he decided not to go ahead. So that was why it wasn't done then. And when I approached the literary executor, it was about 2014, 2015, and just said that I was keen, and he was just like, I'm sorry, but the estate does not support a biography at this time. And a lot of the letters in the archives, and there were a lot of letters in the archives, were restricted. So it was one of those things where I knew I could get access to some things, and I was just like, well, I'll just start and I'll just see how I go. I can pull out at any time. I'm not committing myself. And I spent 6 months at the Fryer Library in the archives, and we were talking before about archive fever. It was so exciting. It was the most exciting thing I've ever done in my life, I think. And there were whole correspondences from the beginning, you know, basically with Alison Hoddenott, her correspondence over 30 or 40 years of her life was there. And I just read through it, and this woman just came to life for me. And she's such a brilliant writer. Her voice is so lively and it's so humorous. I mean, she's hilarious, but she's so quick. She's quicksilver. She constantly surprised me. She made me burst out laughing numerous times in the middle of the library where he's kind of like, oh, sorry. It's like, or gasp in horror sometimes. She's just the most unconventional mind. But she also had this really conventional streak. She lived her life in quite a conventional way. So eventually I had to find alternate ways to get access to this material, but I just couldn't let it go. So,
and that is why the book is so good. So you can hear that excitement in Anne-Marie's voice. It comes through in the book, it comes through in the prose, and it comes through because you have such an access to Gwen's letters and you quote from Gwen's letters so often. And beautiful, Gwen, you had correspondence that lasted for your life, for 50 years, some of them, Tony Riddell. And so this wealth of material which is available, and Anne-Marie weaves it through this story. But we're probably getting ahead of ourselves here. So if we go right back, and we've got little Gwen Harwood, little Gwen Foster growing up in Brisbane. And she's actually something of an incredible talent at the piano. So take me, she's gone to Brisbane Girls Grammar School, she's living, a kind of okay life. We're talking at this stage the late 30s.
Yep.
What's she up to by the time she's about 17 and she's learning her piano? What's one of those first things you take us to, this little Tasmanian housewife?
Yeah, this was something that, this was one of the secrets. Yeah, when she was 17, she began a mad, passionate affair with her 50-year-old pianist teacher, organist teacher, who was married and whose wife was a good friend of her mother's and of the family. And this is part of her unconventionality. She saw nothing wrong with this at all. And she was quite Christian. She was at that stage. She almost simultaneously had a conversion to Christianity, having rejected it as a young woman. And she became intensely religious because she was madly in love with the young rector there at All Saints Church. So, you know.
That's a different lover.
Again, she saw no incompatibility there between being in love with Peter Benny, the young curate, and having this mad passion for Robert Daly Scarlett, who's very well known in Brisbane musical circles. And as I discovered later, actually very well known for having quote-unquote wandering hands. Mm. And somebody said to me, look, it was known that if you were a young woman, you wouldn't want to be alone in his studio with him. And, you know, from our point of view, like, oh, how creepy, you know, an evil abuser. But from Gwen's point of view, woohoo, this is great. You know, she said, yeah, he had his own studio and it had a shower. It's like, and it was right above the chemist, so poof, no worries there. You know,
all the great ways of the 1930s. She is in love with Peter Benny, and the one thing we discover about Gwen Howard is that she loves, mm-hmm. and it's such a salve. It actually lifts my soul reading the book because she falls in love so deeply mm-hmm. and so passionately with people of any age, different gender. It doesn't matter. They are just people and she loves them. However, she continues with a 50-year marriage to a tyrant, but we'll get to that as well. I just want to point out the shock I got. I think I somehow knew about that affair with the piano teacher. I don't know how I knew about that, but I had no idea that she became a Franciscan nun for a little while. Can you tell us about that?
I mean,
why we chose this part?
Yeah. I wish that I had her letters from that period, but I don't. There were some, but they were destroyed, apparently. And when I found that out in the library, I was reading that these letters had been destroyed. I went, oh!
Yes.
Nothing. Sacrilege. It's all good. Yeah, what? Destroyed. But, yeah, she became intensely religious and she really responded to the passion and the pageantry of high church Anglicanism. It's equivalent to Catholicism, but also the mysticism. She was quite selective, I think, in what she took from this, because she certainly didn't take conventional Christian morality from it, for instance. But the mystics are love stories between the soul and God, and she uses that language about her own love affairs throughout her life. And she certainly was very influenced by John Donne, who's the English priest poet, and he again is a poet, extremely erotic poet who uses the language of the Bible and of spiritual passion to talk about physical passion. So I think in some weird way her intense involvement with Christianity actually reinforced her eroticism and her potential and capacity to love and not to distinguish between loving in like a friend way and in a passionate erotic way. The whole gamut of love was open to her no matter who she loved, and sometimes it would express itself in this way and sometimes in a different way. So I think, yeah, she joined the convent, I think, because Peter Benny, her beloved, was committed to celibacy, and I think she thought, if he thinks that's the best way, then I will do that too. Because when she left, and she says she loved being in the convent, but she loved, yeah, she loved everything. When she left, it was around the same time that Peter Benny suddenly decided that actually marriage is really awesome too. And he stopped being celibate and got married to someone else, which was obviously very heartbreaking for her. And so she decided, right, fine.
Right, I'm back on the market.
Yeah, I'm back on the market, exactly.
Of course, she then falls in love with Tony Riddell.
Yep.
And fortunately, they have, as I say, we have these letters over decades and decades.
Yes.
Tony's gay, so he's not interested in marrying her. Damn, but he turns up, that old one of the best friend, Bill Harwood, turns up at the family house. And so Gwen marries Bill Harwood. I'm jumping ahead because we don't have a lot of time, but there's such a big story here. Mm. They move to Tasmania. Bill is ostensibly brilliant. We're told he's brilliant a lot. Again, I remember everything I always knew about Gwen Harwood was, oh, and she had the terrible husband. but actually, it turns out that they had quite a good marriage to start with, that she at some level, she obviously just loved him, because to read the 50 years with Bill is the toughest thing I think I'm reading here. As this woman gets to Tasmania and they're so poor, she can't afford a piano and her fingers ache. And she speaks of the pain in her fingers. And so she turns to poetry. How did you discover this, and what did you feel when you read about this?
Yeah, she was a person, I think, who had to be an artist.
Mm.
I remember when I first read about how she made the direct connection between having to give up music and therefore taking up poetry. She had written before that, but I remember thinking, as if it doesn't matter what art I do, I just have to be an artist. It was an unusual, I kind of was just thinking, you know, you're passionate about one particular thing, but for her, music and poetry were linked as well, and all forms of art she adored. Mm. Mm. But yeah, I think she did love Bill. She fell madly in love with him in the way that she did with people. Mm. And she idealized him and the marriage and the idea of two becoming one in the way that we all do, I think. And she was determined. She felt it was a good way for her to spend her life devoted to him and to the great mind and supporting him and having children and doing all of that. Classic. And for her to have kind of fallen for that is a bit like, oh, but also it's what we all do. It's normal, you know. So it's also endearing in a way. But I think then this came to me that she kind of woke up at a certain point after she started having her children, and she was just like, I don't have time for myself. Where is the part, you know, I'm giving to everybody else, and where is the room for me as a person, which again is a thing I think a lot of women in particular relate to. And I'm giving so much to this relationship and to these children, and they're not reciprocating in that way. They'll take everything I have to give. They'll eat me alive. It was her famous statement.
Yeah. I think the first time I discovered her poetry, I was a second year university student, and I was an older student. I had a 2-year-old, and there's, you know, suburban sonnet, these children are going to eat me alive. And there's this one line, at the end of, I think it's in the park, she's going quietly down to the back corner of the garden. Oh no, she's going down to the back corner of the garden to hate them quietly. And I can remember that moment thinking, oh my God, this is my favourite poet. You just know exactly how I feel. And all the 18-year-olds in my tutor sort of just looking at me. I'm just going, wait, you'll find out about this.
Because she was writing that in the late 50s and early 60s when nobody was doing it. Not even Sylvia Plath. I mean, she was saying these things about motherhood that were challenging the idea of what she called holy motherhood.
Exactly.
And it was it was shocking and unconventional, and it was new.
It was very new. So she's starting to get noticed, and it's a battle, of course, and to get published in the journals, and we might get to her trickery in a moment. But we're talking about the time. So it is the 40s, the 50s, the 60s we're coming into. She's sort of crawling her way out from underneath the tyranny of Bill. She's so poor because she doesn't have a cent. He controls all the money. She's scavenging bits of paper. Now, this is a poet who can't use the piano, so she's scavenging bits of paper. She'll find bus tickets. She'll find anything so that she could write a poem on it. It's extraordinary poverty. In freezing cold Tasmania, which she hates with a passion, possibly because she's hating Bill and her life and all the rest of it, but she's somehow surviving and getting these poems published. If we jump ahead, I'll just forget the hoax for the moment. If we jump ahead a little bit, she starts to get noticed. Different poets come to Tasmania. So we start getting James Macaulay, we start getting Vincent Buckley. Can you tell us a little bit about that kind of milieu that she begins to mix in?
Yeah, it's kind of tricky because when she first started in the 50s, started writing, and she was Mrs. Harwood, and, you know, from Tasmania, that's how she signed her poems. The big poets were Vincent Buckley and Jim Macaulay and A.D. Hope, and they controlled all the, well, controlled in her mind. They were the editors. They were getting published, and they actually were the editors of a number of these journals as well. So,
tell us about the hoax. Go on.
Well, I was going to say her initial feeling was that they were just a row of turnbacks.
Yeah.
She was just like, she was throwing, I imagine her like throwing pieces of screwed up paper at them, and they wouldn't turn around. You know, just like, here are my precious poems, and I can't get any attention from you guys. So yeah, then so she actually, Vincent Buckley had a go at her in print, just a couple of lines, but she never forgot them. He said she was muddled and derivate in one poem, and she was like, I heard an interview with her.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she was like, I'll give you muddled and derivate. Yeah. So it was in her, and she absolutely hated him. And when she hated someone, it was like when she loved them. I mean, every letter she wrote had a nice little knife stick about Vincent Buckley. And yeah, then of course, so well once she became well known, suddenly she met Vin, and his Irish charm completely seduced her, and she fell madly in love with him, and you know, basically he became like her best friend. So, and it was a bit the same with Jim Macaulay, actually. She hated him until she met him. She didn't love him when she first met him, but gradually she began to, yeah, they became, yeah. But yeah, so she did, she was standing there in the 50s, and she felt like her poems were just getting knocked back again and again. Especially, she wanted to publish in Mianjin. She felt that was the best journal. And so she particularly was angry with Clem Christensen for not publishing her brilliant poems. I mean, it took her a while to build up her confidence, but she did feel that she was, what she was writing was at least as good as what was being published. And then she kept seeing all this rubbish getting published, like really some of it is rubbish. And she would just be like, well, how come that person got published, not me? And so she started to get really disillusioned. And who are these guys? Do they even know what they're doing? Are they just publishing their friends? What's going on? And so then she started doing these hoaxes. So she would use pseudonyms, and she would send poems out under false names. And the first
male names,
right, with Walter Lehman, she sent a bunch, of six to the Bulletin, who'd been knocking her back for years, and they took the lot. And she was just like, and so she invented these kind of serious male writers, Walter Lehman and Francis Geyer, who were kind of a bit European sounding, and they immediately got interest from the editors, and she was chortling away in the background, but also really annoyed. And she used to say, what have they got that I haven't got? And so, yeah, the famous hoax is that, yeah, when she's sending these two beautiful poems to the Bulletin, which are Abelard to Eloisa and Eloisa to Abelard, which is this referencing this medieval monk and his love, and it's, you know, it's very high, kind of high literary references, and they're beautiful poems, but they don't really mean much. But of course, each of them is an acrostic, which means that the first letter of each line, if you read it downwards, makes a word or words. And in her case, one of them read "So long, Bulletin," and the other read "F all editors." But she didn't say F. And I mean, this was
fuck
like,
all editors. That's what she said.
Thank you. She said
in the 1950s. 61. So it was pretty radical.
Oh, it was so shocking. People could. The headline was, yeah, things like Taz housewife in hoax of year, and Tasmanian housewife uses filthy words. You know, like. And for a woman, there was this whole kind of, you know, what kind of a woman would use that word? And she was a bit like, come on, nobody else is doing it. Okay, so she sort of backed off a bit then. But that, again, that's a part of her. She always felt like, okay, we all really know that we say these things, but we're just everyone else is pretending, that then everyone else was like, no, we're not pretending. We don't really use that word. So, of course, those poems got published. The Bulletin editor didn't see them, and then all hell broke loose when a couple of students picked it up. And, yeah, of course, that issue sold out. And the Vice Squad came and raided the Bulletin's offices because they'd published an obscene word. And yeah, it got very out of control there for a while.
Do we know how Bill responded? Bill, the husband, did he? I know when you speak about when she's winning these huge awards, or there's this great excitement, or something gets published, and he just continues to read the paper, won't acknowledge it. Just will do whatever he can to just oppress and suppress this woman. Do you know anything about that particular time and when she's causing mayhem?
Initially he was pretty down on her. He said that he felt that she'd exposed the children to this kind of worse negative publicity, and she was getting pretty worried herself. They thought she might have to go to court and all the rest. So initially, yeah, he was bad, but then he turned around and was just like, he became supportive. She said she said, what am I going to do if I have to go to court? And he said, just put the fine in the household accounts under miscellaneous.
That's right.
The household accounts are the key thing here.
Dear. We don't have a lot of time, so I've got to work out what's the best thing we can share with people at this point. Maybe we'll jump to, I'm just wondering, Gwen published a lot of poems of absolutely intense sensuality and sexuality, carnal knowledge, and was pulled up for that. But some of them she wrote under the name Miriam Stone, but some of them she wrote under the name Gwen Harwood. Her husband was extremely possessive. He made, when she first got together with him, he made her cut off contact with Tony Riddell, who'd been his best friend, and it severed her soul. And she tried communicating with him secret, but then it didn't work. And then later, fortunately, they re-established their connection, which, when you're reading this, you can sort of almost breathe again when she starts to write to Tony again. You think she has that soul person that she can talk to. So he sort of continued to remove her from all outside influences, and she's got four children and she's desperately poor. She still manages to survive somehow, and she eventually gets a job typing letters for doctors in Tasmania. And she's thrilled that she's actually got a bit of money, and she wants full-time work. She wants to do this even more. So she's managing to find her way out. I'm wondering if I thought that maybe you might have by now had access to the children, or been able to ask them what it was like when she's publishing these very sensual poems, married to Bill. Was there any kind of discussion in the family? But did you actually get access to the children at all?
I didn't, not before it was published. And yeah, of the papers that I could access, the letters from Gwen to her children were restricted, and I couldn't access those. And I didn't want to, because I knew that the literary executor that I was going to be dependent on for permission to publish was very concerned about his own privacy, with justice. You know, I understood that and I accepted that. So I kind of drew a circle around that, and he was the conduit for access to the other children, so I didn't speak to any of them. I have heard, and so John actually read the manuscript, still telling me no, and we had no contact until he read the manuscript, and then he changed his mind. So I was lucky, but by that stage it was too late. I mean, thank goodness he did, otherwise I was going to have to rewrite and take out all the quotes, which I know, like, her voice is so distinctive. Like, it's like a tissue of her words, my book. And having to do that would have just been... So I am so grateful that he did. But, I mean, yeah, so since then I have heard that... I know he was actually quite... I'm sure he'd be okay with me saying this. He felt very angry at his father after reading my portrait. And I know that he said... Some of the other siblings have felt the same way, some of that they didn't understand. But, yeah.
Families, you got to love them. But, yes, I think that's really interesting. And you weren't lucky that he changed his mind. I think it's a work of such profound respect and love. And, you know, Tom was mentioning the same thing, and it's that whole thing that people theorise that biographers and their subjects, that you spend so much time living with this person, that they invade your dreams, they take over your life. And some people say you fall in love with them, others, you know, I'm not so sure, but it's kind of it grips you, doesn't it? it exhausts you and it grips you.
Yes,
and,
yeah, it's such an intense engagement. Yeah, like, and to have that access to somebody's inner life, Gwen was so good at giving you that kind of access.
Yes.
I think not everybody can do that in their writing. And so it was such a privilege to be up close and personal with this woman and to spend so much time with her.
It was a privilege to read it, and it was a real privilege to read her death, I have to say. And I won't say what happens there, but for those who read the book, it's so moving, those last, you know, few minutes. I'm wondering if it affected your relationship to her poetry at all, writing this book.
Oh, yes. I mean, as I said, I came to know her poetry and I came to know her life more or less at the same time. And as I became interested in her poetry, I wanted to know the stories behind the poetry. Just very non-PC for a literary critic, I have to say, but what were the stories there? So now her poetry is part of my inner world. It's part of my furniture, inner furniture, yeah. Just, I think she's a superb poet, and obviously stylistically and formally, but what I most value in a poet is a person who can show you what it's like to experience moments and feelings, and that's what I get with her, this incredible sense of intimacy, the incredible sense of being able to look into somebody else's life.
And that's what you give us, which is to be so commended. And I have to say, I've written a few literary biographies, and the point about them for me is that I want people to go back to the work of the subject, and that's what I've done having read yours. I'm now back in Harwood land, and luckily I've got all her poetry because I was always a fan, but now it's a reading with new eyes, and I cannot recommend this book highly enough. So if you can join me in thanking Anne-Marie.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this recording, you can find more of them as well as information about our upcoming events via our website.